Respecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Hurricane Beryl is heading towards the Cayman Islands and Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The U.S. National Weather Service in Miami says Beryl is carrying maximum sustained winds of 215 kilometers an hour, making it a Category 4 storm on the center's 5-level scale that measures a storm's destructive potential. The eye of Hurricane Beryl brushed the south coast of Jamaica Wednesday, whipping the island with high winds and heavy rain for hours. The storm knocked out power to the capital, Kingston, and some communities on the northern part of the island. Beryl has killed at least 7 people across the Caribbean since making landfall Monday on Grenada's Carriacou Island, including 3 people on Carriacou and the main island of Grenada. The storm also damaged or destroyed scores of homes and businesses on Carriacou and St. Vincent and the Grenadines, leaving thousands without power and cut off from outside help. Voters in Britain are said to cast ballots in Thursday's parliamentary elections. Leon Blackman, a spokesman for the online bidding platform Oddschecker, says data shows the opposition Labour Party will break the Conservatives' 19-year hold on power.
At the moment, this kind of shows Labour's predicted dominance tomorrow. Now, 451 projected seats, 91 for the Conservatives, 64 for the Lib Dems.
During the final days of campaigning, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak insisted the outcome was not a foregone conclusion. Labour is also warning against taking the election results for granted. The Hamas militant group said on Wednesday it has sent new ideas to mediators in Qatar aimed at ending the nearly 9-month Gaza war with Israel. Israel confirmed it was evaluating Hamas's comments on a deal to free its hostages in the Palestinian territory. This is VOA News. With the death toll mounting and conditions worsening daily for Gazans, both sides are under increased international pressure to agree to a ceasefire, more recently based on a roadmap pushed by U.S. President Joe Biden. A group is saying Israeli settlers in the West Bank have gotten the go-ahead to grab more land. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
The Middle East settlement tracking group Peace Now says Israel has approved the largest seizure of land in the occupied West Bank in over 3 decades, authorities recently approving the appropriation of land in the Jordan Valley. The Palestinians view the expansion of settlements in the occupied West Bank as the main barrier to any lasting peace agreement, and most of the international community views them as illegitimate. Israel's government considers the area to be the historical and religious heartland. Peace Now's data indicate it's the largest single appropriation approved since the 1993 Oslo Accords at the start of the peace process. I'm Charles Villadesma.
An Italian appeals court has upheld the convictions of 2 American men in the slaying of an Italian plainclothes police officer during a botched sting operation, but reduced their sentences. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
The new trial was ordered after Italy's highest court threw out their original convictions. The court on Wednesday convicted Lee Elder Finnegan and sentenced him to 15 years and 2 months in prison. It gave a sentence of 11 years and 4 months, along with a fine, to Gabrielle Natale Hjorth. They were found guilty in the July 2019 slaying of Carabinieri Vice Brigadier Mario Cerciello Rega. The new verdict drew acceptance from the men's families and disappointment from the officer's widow. I'm Haya Panjwani.
U.S. officials' plan to save spotted owls is to kill hundreds of thousands of another owl species. AP correspondent Ed Donahue explains.
Documents obtained by the AP show the strategy by the Fish and Wildlife Service is to deploy trained shooters into dense forests along the West Coast with the goal of killing almost a 500,000 barred owls. They are crowding a declining spotted owl population. Spotted owls are smaller and unable to compete with barred owls. The documents show the plan is to kill about 450,000 barred owls over 3 decades. Past attempts to save spotted owls focused on protecting the forest where they live, setting off bitter fights over logging, but it helped slow the bird's decline. The increase in the barred owl population is undermining that work. Ed Donahue, Washington.
A 4th dairy worker in the United States has been infected with bird flu. Health officials said on Wednesday the worker in the western state of Colorado had an eye infection and has since recovered. The man worked on a dairy farm and had direct contact with infected cows. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa swears in a government of national unity, but there's trouble in the provinces.
At the national level, they were able to strike a deal. But at the provincial level, the DA argued that the ANC must stop behaving as if it is inviting the DA as a junior partner.
A U.S. high school principal will discuss cooperation with Liberia's premier technical school, the Booker T. Washington Institute. Niall Bilson journalists received training in data journalism. East African community women call for harmonized laws on gender equality.
It is still very difficult for women to get access to finances. It's still difficult for women to get opportunities to go to school and to go to work. So those are the things now we want to focus on.
And the U.S. Embassy in Guinea-Conakry and the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta hold a workshop on controlling disease outbreaks. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on Wednesday swore in a government of national unity comprising 11 political parties. However, unlike the national government, the parties agreed to allow the provinces to choose their own government of provincial unity. But the Democratic Alliance, the DA, which came second in the May 29th election, wants provincial governments to be chosen proportionally based on each party's performance in the election. The ANC disagreed and accuses the DA of misrepresenting the statement of intent. Professor Sipo Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me the dispute illustrates that elections have consequences.
When we have elections, normally people expect that the party will get an outright majority, which would be 50% plus one. Now, for the first time after 30 years, the ANC government at national level and provincial level has performed badly, but still remaining the major party that got more votes. So in Gauteng, the ANC got 34%. At the national level, it got 40%. And what the ANC then decided to do, because it still got more votes than all other parties, was to say what the voters have said to the parties is that you have to work together. The ANC decided to say, given the fact that there's so much divisions in this country, it will make sense for us to try to have governments of national unity at both a provincial level as well as at national level. At the national level, they were able to strike a deal. But at the provincial level, the DA sought to argue that the difference between its performance and that of the ANC is simply mere 6%. And the ANC must stop behaving as if when it invites the DA to form this provincial government of unity, it is inviting the DA as a junior partner. And this is where things went wrong. But I think also the attitude of the leader of the DA sounded so haughty and so somehow recklessly and tactless, to an extent that people saw it as a white person who sees himself as having to act as a supervisor of black people. And the premier of Gauteng then decided to talk to all other parties to say, let's have a broad representation. And the other parties came. And as a result, they are able to have more than 50 plus one without the DA. So that is where the challenge is, that now you have at the provincial level and the hub of our economy, an ANC-led government of provincial unity that is without the white party called the DA.
What does they mean now in terms of the functioning of the national government?
Well, at the national government, well, one must take it as, let's see it as an experiment. But what we also know is that the ANC's poor performance was because it had failed to change the material conditions of its traditional constituents. Now that it has less support, the question arises that if you failed to deliver when you had 100% and you were acting alone, what are the chances that you are going to succeed to satisfy your traditional constituency, especially when you have people or members of your cabinet whose agenda is very different?
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Women leaders in East Africa are calling for the enactment of gender-sensitive laws to encourage women participation in leadership, peace, and governance. They made the call at a just-concluded international dialogue in Arusha, Tanzania. Moses Habyarimana reports.
Harmonize the gender-sensitive laws in East Africa was the highlight of the two-day meeting of the region's women. They say enacting such laws will enable them to be empowered to participate in leadership and governance positions. Fatuma Ndangiza is a regional lawmaker from Rwanda.
We still have challenges, especially in corporate world, in the area of private sector. We don't have many women who are in the area of business. And even when they are there, you find they are small traders.
According to the 2024 World Bank report, close to 60% of girls in Eastern and Southern Africa are likely not to be enrolled in secondary schools. They also have more than 20% chance of having a child as a teenager. Ann Ito is a lawmaker from South Sudan.
It's still also very common for parents to pull away their children from school because of workload in the house. It is still very difficult for women to get access to finances. It's still difficult for women to get opportunities to go to school and to go to work. So those are the things now we want to focus on. They could be absence of gender-sensitive laws.
Christina Ayub Haule is a university student in Tanzania.
The challenge a lot of young women face, it's traditions. Also, there's stereotypes. Policemaker, they should make a friendly police so that the young generation or young ladies shall be included in decision making.
The World Bank report for this year indicates that women have about 30% chance of getting married before age of 18. When she reaches working age, she is most likely to work in the informal sector and earn significantly less than her male peers. Masimweni Kathina is a Kenyan and a lecturer at the University of Nairobi.
As we know, as much as we are moving away from our cultural setup that a woman should be at home, not in these spaces that you are a public person, there are also issues of cultural, social norms that are there. There are no careers made for men or careers made only for women. We need to rethink our policies. They were working back then. But as the world is moving, we need to change with the changing times as well.
An ESC report indicates that women, despite constituting over 60% of the East African community population, they are still marginalized in decision-making processes and have limited access to education, finance, information and communication technologies. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
A malicious attack on a mining site in the gold-rich Ituri province has killed at least four Chinese nationals in northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo, according to local sources. The French news agency AFP says several Congolese were also killed or injured in the attack. Some of the local sources attribute it to a militia group called the Kodeko, which claims to defend the interests of the Landu tribe against the rival Hemen tribe. Attacks on mining sites and convoys are common in Ituri and further south in the other gold-rich province of South Kivu, where there are many Chinese miners. Conflicts over gold between Congolese residents and Chinese miners are also common. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 4th. And for more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A group of journalists from the 10 Nile Basin countries are in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, to improve their reporting skills about the River Nile, wildlife, and the environment. Dennis Logonyi is among the journalists and has this report.
The Nile is the longest water body in the world and a backbone of many of Africa's fragile ecosystems. Environmentalists say the Nile faces new threats from climate change, population growth, and economic expansion. Journalists from Egypt, Ethiopia, Sudan, South Sudan, Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, Eritrea, Tanzania, Burundi, and Democratic Republic of Congo are attending a week of training on how to use information, geographic location, and imaging for journalism. Henry Owino, a journalist from Kenya, says training on data collection can help journalists produce researched stories on the Nile.
One of the key things that I've learned is that it adds value to the story. It gives the story credibility. People believe on what you are doing that it has been researched. Most journalists, they are normally, they either do text or they do audio or they are just TV. But now that there's something called convergent, where text is involved, voice is involved, the video is involved, all this combined in a one story. So those who cannot read can listen to the audio part of it. Those who cannot listen can see through the video. And those who can do both, either of them, advantage to them.
The training is funded by InfoNile, a cross-border group of what are called geojournalists who use geographic data to cover stories. The training aims to help journalists cover critical stories on water issues in the Nile River Basin. Rwandan journalist Annonciata Byukusenge says she's grateful for the skills offered in the InfoNile training.
Before the training of the InfoNile in Rwanda, we were not aware about the data journalism. Even myself, I didn't produce any story contain data, but after getting that skills, I produce stories containing data. I'm still more training to learn. I need to be a specialist in data journalism because in my country we have a gap about data journalism.
Owino says journalism has shifted to a new era of technology.
To train journalists for them to adapt these new skills in journalism, it will take time because journalists, they still live in that era of competition. They always want to break news. So those who are doing news, okay, they can run with the news, but if you want to do a proper research story with a background, you have to sit down, you gather your information, your data, and you do a lot of multiple sources, interviews, to help you verify whatever you are writing. For InfoNile to get journalists to do this, they have to train various countries of the Nile Basin.
Frederick Mujira is a Ugandan journalist and co-founder of InfoNile. He says there is a big trust gap between journalists and scientists, and that InfoNile is working to bridge the gap.
We strongly believe that it is important to tell stories using data. Data helps to bring these stories out in a credible way, but also we want communities to take informed decisions based on science. And you know, you cannot tell stories without data and think that you are telling stories with science. We strongly believe that there is a big challenge of funding for journalists. They have no money. They want to tell stories. There are good stories out there. In South Sudan, for example, there are good stories around forests, around national parks, but journalists cannot go to these areas to tell this story because it is extremely hard.
InfoNile provides story grants, training, and mentorship to journalists across the Nile Basin for in-depth coverage on water, environment, biodiversity, and climate. The group has trained 250 journalists since it was launched in 2017. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Kampala.
Liberia's premier technical school, the Booker T. Washington Institute, BWI, celebrated the 95th anniversary of its founding last Saturday, June 29. Local reports say President Joseph Boakai plans to elevate the institution to technical university level. The school is named after Booker T. Washington, a former slave and founder of the Tuskegee Institute in the U.S. state of Alabama. Dr. Carlos Phillips is the principal of the Booker T. Washington High School in Houston, Texas. He has just returned from Liberia, where he visited the BWI campus. He tells me about the plan for cooperation and partnership between BWI Liberia and the Booker T. Washington High School in Houston.
My biggest takeaway from the assessment that was done is that the students at Booker Washington Institute are really passionate about their opportunity to be educated at BWI. The assessment of the teacher discourse as far as what they're able to teach the students, the teachers definitely have the capacity to provide the students with the knowledge. However, the disconnect is the availability of resources that the students would need to help build up their skill set. So when I was there, I had the opportunity to just speak with students to see, you know, what their perception of that campus and what their needs were. And during the visit, the first lecture that I did was with the students in the plumbing class, and I asked them if they could do anything for their campus, you know, what would it be? And a student by the name of Benjamin stood up and stated that he would like to create a restroom facility that is up to date. Then another young lady in the classroom responded by, yeah, I would like a restroom to have hot water, you know, because students that have asthma or the young ladies where they have their personal needs, they need those hot water for, you know, a more appropriate sanitary type of cleansing. And I talked to the students in the electronics classroom, and I noticed that the electricity is, you know, it's not as fluid. So we thought about, hey, let's build this state-of-the-art restroom and we can make it solar. You know, so now we're using alternative energy. We went to the carpentry class and I said, hey, we could use the wood from the carpentry class to build baseboards to support the restrooms. The sewing classes, they can make drapes or whatever they need for the restroom. So it was so many different levels of interest sparked when I spoke with the students about what they could do and how their curriculum could support this project. I mean, the students were just intrigued. And the other phenomenal part about this project, which we call the Benjamin Project, is named after that plumbing student who came up with this idea. These are all freshman students. So, you know, we just put a timeline together of, hey, 4 years.
So are you looking forward to some kind of partnership, cooperation with BWI, Booker Washington Institute, Liberia, in terms of what? I don't know, whether visitation, exchange of students for your students going there? Besides, do you hope to return to Liberia again, a follow-up visit?
Yes, I definitely want to have a follow-up visit in June of next year. That's my dream, to be able to go back to Liberia in 1 year to assess what we've done. I'm in constant communication with Benjamin, the principal, Dr. Freeman. I'm in contact with them since I've left. We've spoken at least 5 times during the week just to see where he is with the project. But as it relates to my students here, so yes, my dream is to go back to Liberia. But while we are away, I want to connect our students with the students in Liberia so that they will be able to work with the students as they are developing the concepts, and we're able to collect resources here that we can raise awareness about the projects that we're doing. So ultimately, I want our students to benefit from the humanitarian side of connecting with another school that is named Booker T. Washington. I want our students to be able to build on their knowledge of alternative energy through engineering, on how we do, you know, certain components here in the U.S. And then I want the students from Booker Washington Institute to have a network that's going to be established here in the U.S. so we'll be able to support them upon graduation. So it is my vision to connect the students in Liberia with such schools such as Prairie View A&M University and also Tuskegee University, just to name a few. But those are two direct schools that we have a close partnership with, that we want those students to be able to continue their education.
Did it surprise you that the students are thinking about building a state-of-the-art restroom at this time?
But it didn't surprise me on the students want to do a state-of-the-art restroom, you know, because I was probing the students on what would you like to do to add value to your campus. And when the students stated that this is what they wanted to do, I immediately connected to figure out, hey, how can I help make this happen? You know, what can I do to make sure that the students know how to bring the connections together, how they go and track resources, how they get attention from the alum. So I wasn't surprised, because just looking at the students, talking to the students, being engaged with the students, you know they really had a desire to learn.
Dr. Carlos Phillips is the principal of the Booker T. Washington High School in Houston, Texas. He was speaking with us from Houston, Texas. The U.S. Embassy in Guinea-Conakry held a collaborative workshop on Wednesday with the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, in Atlanta and USA on disease prevention in Guinea. Karim Kamara reports from Conakry.
According to Dr. Sedu Chair of the World Health Organization, the workshop is essential because Guinea for the past years has been confronted with multiple breakouts, some of which are still around. He says for the past years, Guinea has been affected by polio, meningitis, and Lassa fever, as well as other diseases. He says a recent post-epidemic analysis shows that authorities need to improve early public notification of the disease. He says the workshop offers a unique opportunity to discuss and plan certain reforms that will help strengthen Guinea's response. The 717 model is new to Guinean health workers. Dr. Dilamho Zamohun of the CDC in Atlanta and one of the partners of the project explains what's the meaning of the module.
The 717 is purely arithmetical. What does it mean?
717, 7 days to detect any public health event anywhere in the country, 1 day to notify, and 7 days to respond. And as you can see, it's a timeline, and we want to make sure that any event in the country, any public health threat in the country is quickly detected, quickly notified, and quickly addressed.
The U.S. Ambassador to Guinea, Troy Damian Fretel, says the Biden administration has long been contributing to help public health care in Guinea. Their focus now is on preventing a recurrence of the 2014 deadly Ebola outbreak in Guinea.
The United States' contribution of more than $100 million a year in Guinea for public health. Reasonable, comprehensible levels and expectations on people so that we can react as an institution, as a state, more effectively. These are absolutely critical. That was the huge difference between the Ebola outbreak here in 2014 and the one in 2021. The institutions we created in the meantime, it meant that instead of a catastrophe, it was a situation to be managed. And if we can address these situations early using the 717 model, we can prevent another catastrophe like 2014.
Guinea's Minister of Health, Dr. Omar Joe Ba, explains to participants the essence of the 717 model.
Par cette approche, nos indicateurs de performance de la surveillance seront améliorés.
He says with the approach, the performance indicators of the survey will be improved. He says detection, early notifications, and prompt response health threat will help control the spread of the disease. He says these are the objectives of 717. He says the present workshop came at the best time. He says he is seizing on the occasion to thank the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and Global Fund. The workshop is expected to last for about 2 weeks. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
President Joe Biden's spokesperson says the president is absolutely not pulling out of the White House race. This as pressure mounted on the president following his disastrous debate performance against Donald Trump. According to the French news agency AFP, panic has gripped Democrats in the wake of last week's debate. Internal rumblings about finding a replacement candidate before November's election have been amplified by polls showing Trump extending his lead. The New York Times and CNN reported that Biden, who is 81, had acknowledged to a key ally that his re-election bid was on the line if he failed to quickly reassure the public that he was still up to the job. White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre rejected those reports outright and insisted that Biden had absolutely no intention of withdrawing as the Democratic nominee. And that is it for this Thursday, July 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, saying, have a great day, but please be safe, whatever you do.